We all know what an algorithm is. In cryptography, it's not the algorithm you keep secret. The algorithm should be designed in such a way that if it's discovered, unless the snooper has the key, it's useless to him or her. Many algorithms are publicly published. Key secrecy is what's important. It even goes as far as to say that if you know the algorithm, in other words, you know what mathematics was used, and you also know the ciphertext itself, a good encryption algorithm will still keep the plain text data secret. It sounds impossible, because if somebody told me, the answer is 27, and I know to get that number, the algorithm divided by 10, added 4, then multiplied by 3, I'd be able to pretty quickly calculate the input was 50. But these algorithms use special one-way functions, which we'll look at in a moment, which make that impossible, or at least so difficult you'd never bother attempt to do it. There are two broad classes of algorithm, symmetric and asymmetric. Symmetric algorithms use the same key for both encryption and decryption. Asymmetric algorithms, such as public-private key cryptography, use one key for encryption and a different, though mathematically related, key for decryption. That last sentence sounds counterintuitive, as does the idea that publishing your algorithm still maintains secrecy. But that's the truth. Of course, an algorithm is only secure until or if somebody finds a weakness with it. There is a scenario known as the doomsday scenario. This is the day somebody publishes an algorithm for predicting prime numbers. Almost the entirety of public-private key cryptography, and that's used by protocols such as SSL and TLS, is based on the notion that there is no pattern to a series of prime numbers other than that they're prime. There's a possibility that somebody has already come up with a prime prediction algorithm. It would certainly be in the interest to keep it secret. The encryption algorithm has two inputs, plain text and the key. It has one output, ciphertext. If decrypting data, two inputs, ciphertext and the key. It has one output, plain text. One-way functions. Mathematical functions where it's difficult, or impossible, to get back to the source values, knowing only the output values, are known as one-way functions. There are many, but modular arithmetic gives us a method that is used extensively in cryptography. A simple example is where on a 12-hour clock face you add 5 hours to 9 a.m. and the answer is 2 p.m. Or written down, we could say 9 plus 5 equals 2. Because this is an example of modular arithmetic where the modulus is 12, we'd actually write 9 plus 5 equals 2 brackets mod 12. Let's take a really simple function, 3 to the power of x, where x equals 2. So this is a function for turning 2 into 9, because it's the same as 3 times 3, and that equals 9. There's a direct relationship between the magnitude of x and the magnitude of the function result. Using modular arithmetic can give the function a great property, unpredictability. Look at this table. X has the values 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 along the top, but then when you look at 3 to the power of x, going from left to right, it's 3, 9, 27, 81, 243 and 729. Notice there's a bit of predictability in here because the magnitude of the numbers are related to each other. The numbers get bigger from left to right. But let's have a look at 3 to the power of x mod 7. Then we have this unpredictability pattern falling in. From the left to the right it goes 3, 2, 6, 4, 5, 1. So it starts at 3 and then it goes down to 2. Then it takes quite a big jump up to 6, and then a smaller jump down to 4, and a small jump up to 5, and then a fairly big jump all the way back down to 1 again. Your password in Windows is stored as a one-way function, albeit one that's considerably more complex than what you've just seen. Hashes. There are some very useful algorithms that produce fixed-length strings. For example, it doesn't matter how much data you feed into an MD4 hashing algorithm, you'll always get a 128-bit string out of it. That means there must be rather a lot of input strings that will produce exactly the same output strings. And indeed there are. They're called collisions. They are so rare you might as well consider them never to happen. MD4 is a complicated one-way function, so predicting collisions is, to all intents and purposes, impossible. Unless you keep trying and trying and comparing the output strings. This is, in theory, the only way to find out. It's called a brute force attack. You just use computing power to very quickly run through all the possible combinations. This could take a long time. A very long time. Hashes are very useful because they allow you to perform comparisons very quickly. If you have a large message, you can create an MD4 hash of the message and send a hash to somebody over a slow network. They can run a hash on the data they hold, which they believe to be identical, and compare the hash you sent them with the one they just generated. If they're the same, it means the two data sets are the same. So say if I take the string 1 and put it through hashing functions, I'll end up with MD4, 8BE1EC6, 97B14AD3A53B371436120641D. Or MD5, C4CA4238A0B923820DCC509A6F7 5849B. That was a mouthful. However, if I take the string 2, which is numerically almost identical to the first string, I'll get massively different results. MD4, I'll get 26870490D90DA05D5C9D9AEBED9CDE2A8. That's very different to the first string. And MD5, I'll get C81E72 8D9D4C2F636F067F89CC14862C. Again, a very different value to the MD5 hash for the value 1. Now, all this stuff comes in very useful with digital signatures, which I'll describe a little later. But just remember what I've said about hashes. Key distribution. The problem with encrypting and decrypting data in the way I've told you so far is that you somehow have to get the decryption key safely to your partner. It could easily be intercepted in this day of us all being permanently online. It's the age-old problem that generals have had of communicating with their officers in the field for centuries. If the messenger who has the key is captured, all your communication can be decrypted, whether or not subsequent messengers know the key. And this is called the key distribution problem. Three mathematicians came up with an answer to this problem: Diffie, Hellman, and Merkel. They do an exchange of data which can be intercepted by anybody, which allows both the sender and the receiver to generate the same key, but doesn't allow the interceptor to generate the key. Sounds incredible? It's actually very simple to explain now that you understand modular arithmetic. It comes in four steps. Let's imagine Alice wants to send a message to Bob. So Alice chooses a number, A, and keeps it secret. Let's say that A equals 3. At the same time, Bob chooses a number, B, and Bob keeps it secret. So let's say that B equals 6. Step 2. Alice puts 3 through this algorithm. 7 to the power of A mod 11. Well, 7 to the power of A mod 11 is 7 cubed mod 11, which equals 343 mod 11, which equals 2. So just remember that. At the same time, in step 2, Bob puts 6 through 7 to the power of B mod 11. Well, 7 to the power of 6 mod 11 is the same as 117,649 mod 11, which is 4. Just remember that. Step 3. Alice calls her result alpha. So she sends the number 2 to Bob across a network. At the same time, Bob calls his result beta, and now remember that was 4, and he sends that to Alice. So Alice has sent the value 2 to Bob, and Bob has sent the value 4 to Alice. Anybody who is on the network at the time that these messages are sent can intercept those messages, capture them, and understand what they are. Now, Alice, in step 4, puts her number, beta, through the formula beta to the power of a mod 11. So that's 4 to the power of 3 mod 11. And that equals 64 mod 11, which is 9. At the same time, in step 4, Bob puts alpha through alpha to the power of b mod 11, which is 2 to the power of 6 mod 11, which equals 64 mod 11, which equals 9. What you notice now is they both have the same value, 9. But there's no way for an interceptor to work out what that value is, even if they intercept the values that they exchanged across the network in steps 3 through to 4. From this point on, they can use 9 as their encryption and decryption key. All I can tell you is that it works. Why it works, I have no idea. I'm very poorly educated. However, I'm happy to live with the fact that it just works. If it's beyond you, you're not alone. Maybe you're also poorly educated. I do think it's really clever, neat, and cool, though. Asymmetric key encryption. We use one key to encrypt and a related key to decrypt data. You can actually swap the keys round, but the point is you don't have one key. This gets round the key distribution problem. There's a great way of describing the difference between symmetric and asymmetric key encryption. It involves the use of a box to put messages in, and we have to assume the box, its clasps, and the padlock used to lock it are impossible to penetrate. Symmetric key. You send a messenger out with a copy of the key. He gets it to your recipient, who lives 10 miles away. On the way, he stops at a pub and has his pocket picked. The key is whisked off to a locksmith, who copies it, and then is secreted back into the messenger's pocket. Sometime later, you send a messenger with the box containing your message. You are confident that your recipient is the only one who can read the message because the original messenger returned and reported nothing unusual about the key. The second messenger stops at the same pub. He is pickpocketed. The copy key is used to unlock the box and read the message. The box, with its message intact, is secreted back into the messenger's pocket. You and your recipient have no idea that your communication has been compromised. There is no secrecy. Asymmetric key. Your recipient has a padlock and key. He keeps the key in a private place about his person. Let's therefore call it a private key. He puts the padlock into the box but leaves it unlocked. He doesn't mind if anybody sees the padlock. It's publicly viewable. Even though it's not really a key, let's call it a public key. He sends a messenger to you with the box. The messenger stops at the pub and is pickpocketed. All the snoopers see is an open padlock. They secretly return the box. The messenger then arrives at your door. You take the padlock out of the box and you put your message into it. You use the open padlock to lock the box, snapping it shut, and you send the messenger on his way. He again stops at the pub and is pickpocketed. They find only a padlocked box, no key. They have no way of getting into the box. They secretly return the box to the messenger's pocket. The messenger gets to your recipient, who uses the key he secreted in a private place about his person, the private key, and uses it to unlock the padlock and read the message. Secrecy is maintained. You can see the process is a bit more complicated for asymmetric key than for symmetric key encryption, so it's not something you'd want to do often. So what's often done is that instead of putting a message in the box and padlocking it, a symmetric key is put into the box and padlocked. That way you solve the key distribution problem. That's what happens with computer cryptography mostly. Public-private key cryptography is used to transport a symmetric key that is used for message exchanges. One reason for doing this is that asymmetric key crypto, or public-private key crypto, as it's known, is expensive in terms of computing power, whereas symmetric key crypto is much more lightweight. When you see that a website uses 256-bit encryption, they're talking about the symmetric key that is used after the public-private key crypto was used to transport the symmetric key from sender to receiver. Often the key length of public and private key cryptography is 2048 bits. You may have found yourself confused when setting up IIS with 256-bit SSL encryption and seeing keys of 1020 or 2048 bits. This is why. It's the difference between what's called the session key and the public and private keys. Let's take the example of an e-commerce web server that wants to provide SSL support so you can send your credit card details securely over the internet. The public and private keys are held on the e-commerce web server. The private key is heavily protected in the key store. Many organizations will go as far as to have a special tamper-proof hardware device to protect their private keys. The public key doesn't need to be protected because it's, well, public. You could have daily printouts of it in the newspapers and have it broadcast every hour, on the radio. The idea is that it doesn't matter who sees it. The website generates the public and private keys. They have to be generated as a key pair because they're mathematically related to each other. You retrieve the public key from the website and use it as your encryption key. You're not just going to send your credit card information across the internet yet. You're actually going to generate a symmetric key, and that is going to become the plain text input data to the asymmetric encryption algorithm. The ciphertext will traverse the internet, and the e-commerce site will now use its private key to decrypt the data. The resulting output plain text will be the symmetric key you sent. Now that both you and the e-commerce site have a symmetric key that was transported secretly, you can encrypt all the data you exchange. This is what happens with a URL that starts https:// There are still a couple of problems to solve here, but let's put them on the back burner for a little while. We need to understand digital signatures and certificates for those problems. In the meantime, let's have a peek at the mathematics inside the public-private key algorithm. There's an interesting little storyette around this algorithm. A researcher in the UK's GCHQ called Clifford Cox invented the algorithm in 1973. However, working for GCHQ, his work was secret, so he couldn't tell anybody. About 3 years later, three mathematicians, Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, and Leonard Adelman, also invented it. They went on to create the security company RSA, which stands for Rivest, Shamir, and Adelman. It is said the RSA algorithm is the most widely used piece of software in the world. First, we'll generate the public key. We pick two random giant prime numbers. In this case, I'll pick two small primes to keep it simple, 17 and 11. We multiply them together to get 187. We then pick another prime, 7. That's our public key. Two numbers, pretty simple. Now we use the public key to generate the private key. We run it through the algorithm in the diagram. You can see we use modular arithmetic. Obviously, the number would be massive in real life, but here we end up with a private key of 23. The function 7 times d equals 1 mod 160 has that look of simplicity, but it's not like that at all. With large numbers, we'd need to use the extended Euclidean algorithm. I have to say my eyes glazed over and I was found staring into the distance when I read this about it. The extended Euclidean algorithm is particularly useful when A and B are coprime, since X is the modular multiplicative inverse of a modulo B. That meant nothing to me, but it doesn't matter because we can still explain it in simple terms. Now, we want to use that to encrypt a message. To keep things simple, we'll send a single character, X. ASCII for X is 88. As we're the sender, we only know the public key's two values, 187 and 7, or N and E. Running 88 through the simple algorithm gives us the value 11. We send the ciphertext value 11 to the e-commerce web server. The web server has access to the private key, so it can decrypt the ciphertext. The web server passes the plain text through the algorithm shown above and gets the original X that was sent, the bit that says plain text equals 11 to the 3 mod 187. Okay, there's actually a problem here. In this message, every x would come out in ciphertext as the value 11. We could perform a frequency analysis attack on the message. In the English language, certain letters tend to appear more frequently than others. The letters E and I, for example, are very common, but X and Z are uncommon. There is a signature that could be used to find the content of a message. We therefore need to encrypt much larger blocks of data than just one byte at a time. That gives us a random nature. Digital signatures. Asymmetric keys, as mentioned earlier, can be swapped around. If you use one key for encryption, you must use the other key for decryption. This feature comes in very handy for the creation of digital signatures. You've heard of digitally signed documents, Authenticode, digitally signed applications, digital certificates, and so on. In the diagram, you can see all we've done is combine some plain text into the same message as its equivalent ciphertext. When it's time to check a digital signature, we reverse the process. To check a message, we decrypt the encrypted portion and get plain text. When we compare that to the plain text in the message, if the two sets of plain text are different, it means either the plain text in the message has been altered and that accounts for the difference. The ciphertext in the message has been altered and that accounts for the difference. They have both been altered and that accounts for the difference. In order to have a consistent message, the attacker would need to have access to the key that was used to generate the ciphertext. Do you remember earlier I talked about hashes? Well, because a message might be quite large, it's often best to generate a hash of the message and encrypt that. If it's an ND5 hash, it means you'll only have to encrypt 128 bytes. When you come to perform the validation of the signature, you have to take the plain text portion and generate a hash before you do the comparison. It just uses the CPU more efficiently. In this case, the message consists of a small section of ciphertext because the string size of the input plain text was reduced through hashing before it was encrypted. It also includes the plain text of the message. Depending on the data you are looking at, you'll often even find the keys you can use to decrypt the message in the plain text within the message body. It seems like complete madness because anybody who intercepts the message could simply modify the plain text portion of the message and then use the included key to generate a new ciphertext value. That would make the message consistent. However, if the plain text key included in the message is the message issuer's public key, then the attacker would need access to the corresponding private key, which they won't get because it's, well, private. But even with this, there's still a problem. How do you know the message came from the sender it purports to come from? As an attacker, I could easily generate my own key pair. I could then create a message that says I am the issuer and use my private key to create the encrypted part of the message. When you come to check the message, you'll know that it definitely wasn't tampered with in transit. But how do you know you can trust the public key embedded into the message? How do you know that it's me that created the message? That's where digital certificates come into play. Certificates. Certificates are data structures that conform to a specification, X509. But really, they're just documents that do what we just talked about. The plain text data is the public key, plus other distinguishing information, like the issuer, the subject name, common name, and so on. It's then hashed, and the hash is encrypted using the private key of a special service called a certification authority, a CA. That's a service that issues certificates. When we protect a web server with an SSL certificate, we go through a two-stage process, generating a certificate request, and then finishing it off by receiving and installing the certificate. The request part generates a public and private key. The public key plus the distinguishing information is sent to the CA, which then creates a digitally signed document, signed using the CA's private key. The document conforms to X509 certificate standards. The certificate is returned by the CA, and we install it on our web server. Anytime anybody connects to the web server over SSL, they retrieve the certificate and perform a signature validation on it. Remember, it was signed by the CA's private key, so they have to have the CA's public key to perform the validation. If you go into Internet Explorer's Internet Options, and then to the Content tab, you'll see a Certificates button. That shows you all the CAs, or certificate authorities, you have certificates, and therefore public keys, for. It means, if you see a certificate that was signed by a CA on a website, in theory, the CA did a check to make sure the requester was indeed the requester, before issuing the certificate. It means that you have to trust that the CA did a good job of checking the requester's validity before issuing the certificate. Even this creates a minor problemette. How do you know the CA's certificate wasn't created by an imposter of some description? Well, it can have its certificate signed by a CA higher up the food chain than itself. Eventually, you get to a CA at the top of the food chain, and this is called a root CA. Internet Explorer and all the other browsers have all the main root CAs for the internet built in. These are trusted organizations. They have to be. They are so trusted, they are able to sign their own certificates. You may from time to time play with a Visual Studio command line tool called makecert.exe. It's a tool that creates self-signed certificates. If you're just using them for development purposes on a local machine, they're probably fine. You trust yourself, presumably. Sometimes you can use self-signed certificates on internet-facing services. For example, if you load your own self-signed certificate to a service and you are sure nobody intercepted it while you were uploading it, because you were using SSL maybe, it means you can have private conversations with the service and you can be sure the service is the service you issued the certificate to. If you just sent the naked certificate, they'd be able to encrypt messages that only you could decrypt because you'd have the private key. It's possible to also include the private key when you create a certificate. If you send one of these certificates to an internet service, they can digitally sign messages they send to you with your private key. Because you were assured that you gave the private key only to the service, you can be sure the messages are genuinely coming from that service and not an imposter. You do have to trust the service to do a good job of keeping your private key private. Of course, it wouldn't be practical if every time you wanted to buy something on the internet, in order to create an SSL connection, you had to first upload a self-signed certificate. That's why there is a large infrastructure of CAs and root CAs built on the internet. This infrastructure is called a public key infrastructure, or PKI. Many organizations have their own internal PKIs. You can see in Internet Explorer's options, in the certificates button, there is a list of trusted root certificate authorities, and here they all are. You can see different company names here that are issuing digital or providing root CA services, and there's some quite well-known names here, for VeriSign, for example. You can also see, if we go to the personal certificate store, that I have a number of certificates here, and this one, for example, if we view it, I can look at the certification path, and I can see that it was issued by MSIT TPM3. So there is an intermediate CA that issued that to me, and it's owned and operated by Microsoft. And there is another one here, MSIT TPM root. So that, because it's at the top of the tree, is a root certificate authority. And that means I should be able to find that one in my list of trusted roots. So if I close this down and go back to the list of trusted root certification authorities and look for it, MSIT TPM root, there it is. And so that's one of the trusted roots that we have for our own internal PKI. We've now come to the end of this session. And if we just do a quick review, we had a look at keys and algorithms and the importance of secrecy to the keys and not to the algorithms themselves. We looked at one-way functions and the importance of modular arithmetic and also prime number arithmetic. And one-way functions fed in very nicely to the concept of hashes, the idea that you could get a constant length string for any size of input, such as from an MD4 or an MD5 hash. then had a look at symmetric key and asymmetric key encryption, and that led on to public and private key cryptography, and we went into areas like the RSA encryption algorithm and Hellman-Diffie-Merkle encryption. We then had a look at the way that you could use some of these things together and create digitally signed documents or digital signatures. And then we looked at a very specific format of digitally signed document called a digital certificate. And that led on to certificate authorities, and certificate authorities led on to PKI. If you want to know more about this kind of thing, I tend to blog on cloud and security technologies on my blog at http://aka.ms/plankytronics with 2 x's. http://aka.ms/plankytronics.